want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful that you've downloaded this program, and I'm grateful for the support of listeners like Jeffrey Adair, Michael Gill, Patricia Player, and Kathleen Lowy. They're all voluntary subscribers, and you can do it too. If you're able financially and so inclined, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage are the links, and our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. In today's podcast, a stunning development. Pre-9/11 intelligence reveals that our intelligence agencies knew that Al-Qaeda was planning to use airplanes, and they knew the targets, the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon. Truthout's Dr. Jeff Kay will join us in a moment. And in the second portion of our podcast today, Chicago attorney Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office with details about the FBI raid last September that targeted 23 peace activists. And they have not yet been indicted. He'll update us on this case coming up in the second half of our podcast. And I want to dedicate today's program to the memory of my dad, who passed away 40 years ago today. I miss him every day. He taught me about politics, about business, and most of all, how to debate. Thanks a lot, Dad. And if they stare, just let them burn their eyes. Are you moving? Dr. Jeff Kay returns to address questions about whether a secret intelligence unit had information about 9/11 and did not share it with the congressional committees investigating 9/11. And the story revolves around a highly placed source who apparently is a Black Sabbath fan, because his code name, like this song, is Iron Man. Dr. Jeff Kay is a San Francisco Bay Area psychologist who has been writing for truthout.org for several years now. And together with my colleague and friend Jason Leopold, he has recently broken a series of stories based on intelligence from a gentleman who is known as Iron Man. Dr. Jeff Kay, welcome back to our program.
Hi, great to be here, Peter.
Tell me a little bit about Iron Man, and does the name derive from a fascination with the heavy metal band Black Sabbath?
Not to my knowledge. He was an intelligence professional who worked for the Naval Criminal Investigative Service some years ago, who later went to work for an agency most Americans haven't heard of, the Joint Forces Intelligence Command. It's a military intelligence component attached to one of the major U.S. military commands. U.S. military is divided into different commands worldwide. The one JFIC is attached to is called Joint Forces, or United States Joint Forces Command.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the name Iron Man. It was the term given to him by the Inspector General, the Department of Defense's Inspector General Department, when they released a report of their own investigation on his allegations a few years ago.
Uh-huh. And before we get to the meat of the story, and there are some very important developments that you've reported here, how did you make contact with Iron Man and this very significant information?
Well, I wrote a story for Truthout last month in May because I came across this Inspector General report while trolling the Internet, I guess you could say, looking for actually information on torture in government documents related to it, which is more of what I usually have written about.
Right.
And I stumbled upon this, and it was small enough, only 30 pages or so, and the title of it intrigued me. So I took a look at it. The report's name, Stephen Aftergood over at Federation of American Scientists had requested it by Freedom of Information Act. And it was called Review of Joint Forces Intelligence Command Response to 9/11 Commission. I said, oh, let's take a look at that. And in it, I discovered this story, which I then wrote up at Truthout about how although this report was to essentially dismiss the various allegations that the Iron Man had complained about, they did admit in their report that his organization had been tracking Osama bin Laden in 1999-2000, that the commander had come to them one day and told them to stop doing it. And I thought that was a very interesting story, given that in the previous weeks we had been, you know, listening to and witness to all of the news around the tracking and killing of Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
It was a piece of that history that has never been discussed before.
So, Jeff, this order to stand down on monitoring and pursuit of Osama bin Laden, do we have a rough time frame for that?
I believe it occurred in early 2001.
Okay, so prior to 9/11, but after the Bush administration had taken office.
I believe so, but, you know, I don't, none of these documents, there is no precise date.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the central conflict in your story is that Iron Man appears to be deeply offended that the investigations, and I want to be clear to separate the 9/11 commission that was headed by Hamilton and Kaine, from the congressional committees. There were House and Senate committees that prior to the formation over the objections of the White House of the official 9/11 commission, these House and Senate committees had been doing some investigation of 9/11. I don't know anybody who was blown away by the depth of their work. But the critical issue here is that this JFIC agency appears to have lied to Congress and said that they had no documents of note about 9/11, when in fact they clearly did.
Yes, exactly. That I think he found it. He must have found it deeply disturbing. He and his colleagues had been working and done apparently exemplary work in tracking not just Osama bin Laden but other alleged terrorists, Mullah Omar as well. And they had worked with closely with other agencies in the government, particularly those involved in signals intelligence, the National Geospatial Tracking Agency, and you know, they had come up with targets of houses and had passed that information on. And when the questions were tasked by the Senate and House, it was a joint inquiry. Look at what intelligence agencies had done prior to 9/11. A request went out from the Senate. Apparently, it was routed through the Department of Justice, and then from there to the this part is unclear to me, but it ended up on the desk of the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who then passed it on to the different commanders. He specifically had written to the United States Joint Forces Command, who then turned around and gave it to JFIC. And there was a questionnaire, and it came back, and Iron Man discovered through a colleague, according to his letter to the Inspector General, which Truthout reproduced. Jason and I posted it in the new story, and anyone can read it. It's been declassified. That the documentation of what they had done had not been passed on to Congress. And so he went to the Congressional Affairs Office of the Defense Intelligence Agency and said, you know, I have some of this information. He was still working, and not anymore for JFIC, but for another part of the intelligence community, and he was still giving presentations within that community on the work that his division, called the Asymmetric Threat Division, or called DO5,
mm-hmm.
a very spooky acronym, not quite what it is.
Yeah, their names and acronyms can dizzy you, and I was just reading a book about Area 51,
yeah.
and going back to the Cold War era of the 1950s, and they described how the Soviets had been able to set up what they called like a field of mirrors, and that you really couldn't tell the reality from the various variations that they were able to create and project. And that's what I'm reminded of when I see this array of agencies with these special names. And it just shows, you know, how this has burgeoned since 9/11. But a lot of these agencies were in place before that and not communicating or cooperating with one another.
Yes, and that certainly was one of the findings of both the House Senate committees, intelligence committees, and later the 9/11 Commission. And I think it is borne out to a certain extent by what Iron Man is reporting. It also, you know, but it's unclear at this point until we have a real investigation that looks at all the facts that are gathered and not ones that are suppressed. We just won't know to what degree, how much bureaucratic bungling, how much was bureaucratic rivalries, how much was deliberate suppression of information for some other purpose involved in all of this. So we're just reporting it.
And Jeff, I'm looking at your story dated May 23rd of this year.
Yes.
And in it, you reference Able Danger, which was one of the data mining operations under the Defense Intelligence Agency. And one of its members, Anthony Schaefer, went public with the assistance of former Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And Schaefer has been dying to tell his story. And in fact, he wrote a book. And it was vetted by the various agencies. It went to press. And then they decided that even what they had redacted was insufficient. And so the Pentagon bought up every copy of Tony Schaefer's book and destroyed them at a cost to taxpayers of somewhere around $50,000. Does Able Danger play into the work that Iron Man has been describing to you?
Not in any way that I know, but
okay.
I will say, except for one possible thing, the Able Danger was certainly associated in part with the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, and the DIA plays a prominent role in our story because apparently the information gathered by JFIC would go or was certainly passed on to the DIA, and more specifically, when Iron Man was trying hard, again, he had this information, the documentation that JFIC didn't pass on, Iron Man gave some of it that he had in his personal possession to the DIA, Congressional Affairs Office, the office in which the DIA articulates with Senate and House staff. And they apparently, either Congress suppressed it, which I tend to doubt, although it's possible, again, we need an investigation, or more likely, the Defense Intelligence Agency, at that point, even though JFIC didn't pass it on, Iron Man did, but it still never made it to Congress. And the agency involved who had that information was the Defense Intelligence Agency, the same agency that was involved in the creation of the data mining project known as Able Danger.
Mm-hmm.
So the DIA, you know, the CIA gets all the press, but as the 9/11 report noted, 9/11 Commission report noted, and then basically didn't go into any details. 80%, literally, that's the quote from the Commission's report. 80% of the intelligence budget of the United States goes to to military intelligence.
Wow.
80%. Now, a lot of that goes to satellites. A lot of that, you know, is under the Department of Defense. The NSA's massive, you know, cyber surveillance efforts But another huge agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, you don't see too many books written about them. You don't see many articles. The CIA gets all the press. But, you know, there certainly is almost zero transparency about this. And, you know, there's been a real fall down by United States, domestic journalists and blogosphere in basically giving a free ride to the military in many ways. When somebody speaks out, they get, you know, pretty well attacked or they get summarily ignored.
Let me amplify your comments there, Jeff, because I am out of the proverbial closet. I don't believe the official story of 9/11.
Right.
And I hasten to add, because it's very important to, I think, stake out my position clearly, I don't jump to conclusions. I don't believe the official 9/11 story. I don't think the Twin Towers or Building 7 came down simply because airliners hit the tall towers. At the same time, I don't come to a conclusion that it was, quote-unquote, an inside job. I don't have enough evidence to convince myself that our government was complicit in the events of 9/11. But I do suggest that there was grave negligence, and that evidence is clearly mounting as people like Iron Man get frustrated with being, withholding in what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really think that we clearly need a real objective and unfettered investigation into these events. And for me, the reported death of Osama bin Laden is the pivot point. And we have an alleged treasure trove of information, put aside the alleged porn collection. But, you know, his communications should clearly give us the evidence needed to convince skeptics like me that Osama bin Laden had a direct role in the events of 9/11 and that Al-Qaeda truly was the group that brought these events on. I'm prepared to be persuaded of that, but the evidence so far has not been introduced to the record, and the corporate media is complicit with the government in foisting on us a narrative that doesn't hold up to close scrutiny, either along the lines of basic physics, the timelines of events that occurred that day, the conflicting accounts of first responders and others who were on the scene in New York and at the Pentagon. And so we have created a whole concoction about the events of 9/11, and I, for one, would like to see an honest investigation, probably fronted by a non-American, to really get to the bottom of these questions.
Right. Well, I think what makes Jason, the story Jason and I wrote, so important is that while there have been numerous stories that an FBI agent here or an informant there over the years, prior to 9/11 or the months prior to 9/11, had given information about attacks coming, airplanes, or even the World Trade Center or Pentagon. What we have here is a major, not just some small, but a major intelligence component of the U.S. government, who worked, by the way, very closely with domestic elements of the military involved in protecting this country domestically, the Joint Task Force Civil Support out of Fort Monroe, Virginia. Again, hardly, nothing, really never reported by the press. Where not only does our story open up this, it looks at ways in which the military has been involved in terrorist response operations within the continental United States, providing military assistance to civil authorities on this.
Mm-hmm.
And
which appears to be in violation of posse comitatus.
Well, it could. I don't know. I can't say that. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What degree and what they're running, what kind of scenarios they had. In any case, this Iron Man's organization, for which he was a deputy head and then later acting head of the DO5 for at the Joint Forces Intelligence Command, who was doing all this analytical work, not just, you know, this is definite proof that the Intelligence Committee had in their hands and at high levels. The Iron Man report and briefings were disseminated and briefed to dozens and dozens and dozens of different intelligence professionals at agencies, including the DIA, the CIA, the NSA, military officials at Joint Task Force Counterterrorism. That didn't come along until later. Right. Joint Task Force Civil Support, the NCIS, which people know from the TV show. These people had been aware of JFIC's role in preparing original analysis on Al-Qaeda. And back to the letter, again, which people can download and read themselves from truthout.com. Truthout.org.
.org, right. And I'll link to it. It'll be in the show file at peterbcollins.com.
Yeah, and you can look and see. Of course, the names are all redacted, but we have here, you know, almost a half a page of names redacted. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many names that can be, but I imagine that's some dozens. Redacted from these agencies. So not only did JFIC lie, but CIA had information, DIA had information, NSA had information, NCIS had information, and none of them reported this, frankly, to the Senate and Congressional Investigating Committees or the 9/11 Commission.
And did Iron Man give you any indication of how and with whom the information was shared prior to 9/11?
Well, the information would have gone to those agencies. Those agencies I just mentioned had all been briefed on their work with tracking, on intelligence on Al Qaeda, is how he puts it. I can't say.
Because what you report is that the conclusion drawn by the group that Iron Man was working with, DO5,
yes,
was that Al-Qaeda was likely to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Yes.
And that this was a very clear description of the events that actually did transpire.
Yes.
And the reason I'm trying to get specific about who the information was shared with is we know, for example, that the NSA... had Osama bin Laden's satellite phone and was able to tap both sides of the conversation.
Yes.
Michael Scheuer at the CIA, running the ALEC desk that was charged with following Osama bin Laden, had access to only one half of Osama bin Laden's satellite telephone calls. And he actually sent a partial transcript of the half that he was able to decipher over to the NSA and said, "Would you please give us the rest of it?" And they said no. The other embarrassment was that the FBI was trailing the people who presumably became hijackers on 9/11, and four of them camped out in a cheesy motel in Fort Meade, Maryland, within a stone's throw of NSA headquarters the night before September 11th.
Yes.
And so we have this tragic comic lack of communication between these alphabet soup agencies that are out there spying all over the place and stovepiping the information.
Right, yes. Well, one very important example, which we highlighted in the article, and does give a kind of a time frame, for whatever reasons, Iron Man, who I think is an intelligence professional for a number of years in his letter, was going to be precise, but he wasn't going to do anything that would reveal or cause him perhaps to go to jail. So, but he, in his letter, he states that it was in the summer of 2000, that they held a briefing to senior intelligence officials for the United States Joint Forces Command. That's very high military intelligence officials on the WMD threat to the United States. The title of the briefing. And at that briefing, among all the senior intelligence officials, also was there was the deputy commander-in-chief of the United States Joint Forces Command, Vice Admiral Martin J. Meyer. We know it was Meyer because he was, other sources tell us that he was the deputy commander-in-chief at that time. Sources, public sources available on the Internet. The person is only identified in Iron Man's document as DCINC, D-C-I-N-C, but that acronym means Deputy Commander-in-Chief. You know, we put the puzzle pieces together, that's who it was. In their analysis, in their presentation, they indicated that both World Trade Centers number 1 and 2 were the most likely buildings to be attacked by Al-Qaeda, followed closely by the Pentagon. This is quote from Iron Man. He also writes, "The briefer indicated that the worst-case scenario would be one tower collapsed onto another." And that in their discussions, they included findings that the buildings could be struck by a jetliner. They even, in fact, as a result of their intelligence on this, some of the people at DO5 wanted to alert World Trade Center security and engineering architectural staff that their buildings were in danger.
And World Trade Center security was managed by Marvin Bush at that time.
So if they, well, whatever that was, whatever the fate of that would have been, they never were alerted.
Yeah.
At least not by DO5, because they said a command climate discouraged contact with civilians.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Vice Admiral Meyer, what I thought was interesting, I was doing research for the story, apparently also told the commander of NORAD, Major General Larry Arnold, according to Larry Arnold's own testimony in a book that came out recently, and other high-level NORAD staffers who were in the room with him, 2 weeks before 9/11, that, quote, their concern about Osama bin Laden as a possible threat to America was unfounded. And that, to repeat, if everyone would just turn off CNN, there wouldn't be a threat from Osama bin Laden. This was said by a vice admiral who told the commander of NORAD this, even though he himself had been present at briefings at high levels, including the briefing that Iron Man would have been at. And that's how he knows this, that, in fact, World Trade Centers 1 and 2 were the most, and the Pentagon were the most likely buildings to be attacked by Al-Qaeda, including possibility of being struck by a jetliner. Despite the fact he had this information, he told the head of NORAD that their concern about Osama bin Laden was unfounded.
And, so, Jeff, this came up in a recent conversation about the way the intelligence community reacted to essentially being blamed for the false notion of WMD in Iraq. And that when it came to the analysis of the threat posed by Iran and its alleged desire to develop a nuclear weapon, that the intelligence community has been much firmer with the executive branch, both with Bush and Obama.
Yes.
And Seymour Hersh's recent article in the New Yorker describes that. And I mention that as a reference point because I think it's consistent with Iron Man's behavior.
Yes.
That those who feel that they've been falsely blamed for the vulnerabilities of our country on 9/11 don't want this left on their headstones.
Yes.
And they are trying within the system and within the constraints of their own commitments to, you know, in order to get security clearances.
Yes.
They're trying, it seems, to get the truth out.
Yes.
And that's why truthout.org is a great place for them to do it.
Yes. Yes. Iron Man definitely, quite specifically, has said that he... That the possibility of capturing bin Laden early, a year, 2 years perhaps, before 9/11, of possibly thwarting the attacks on 9/11 themselves was a burden that he feels very heavily in it. He no longer wants to carry.
Well, and you open the story by saying that every year on September 11th, he goes into a pretty deep funk.
Well, that is not the only time. What he, it's any time. I think any time he sees a film clip, a scene, you know, I think for the men and women who worked hard and were trying to save, you're trying to save somebody, you're trying to save lives, and then you find out that the information that you had was ignored, and then thousands of people died. I mean, that can give you, that's traumatic. That's
yeah.
a traumatic thing. It's like seeing people die in front, you know, and you didn't just hear about it. You saw it on TV over and over again. That induces, frankly, a traumatic state in an individual. And he certainly shows signs of it. He's the psychological and physiological reactivity to things that remind him of it is horrendous. I'd say that his on a personal level, his wanting to get this out has a political dimension, but it also has a personal dimension, a therapeutic, if you will, dimension to help him unburden himself. and that of his friends. So he mentions one in particular who we know has been identified as Kirk von Ackerman, who is an interesting side story to all of this, who even to this day, his colleague, DO5, who helped him with the intelligence, apparently was quite a brilliant analyst himself, is today still the longest missing man in Iraq, the Iraq War. He was a military contractor, and he disappeared in 2003. No sign of him. With in his car was his computer and $40,000 in cash.
Wow!
It's a very mysterious story. It's been written up by Susie Dow at E Pluribus Medium Media, and some other people have written on it over the years, but not very much. And it's unclear, you know, how. But in any case, for Iron Man, we don't know what really happened to Kirk von Ackerman.
Yeah.
But in this story, it plays a role because apparently Iron Man is also motivated by the idea that this man's legacy is now unknown, what he really did and achieved, and others like Iron Man and with him, you know, trying to do the right thing. As they saw it. Now, whether or not politically we should be invading other countries and labeling people terrorists is another story.
Sure.
I'm not making political judgments here. I'm talking about getting the truth out to people about what really happened, and as are you. And I really applaud the work you've been doing.
Well, thank you, Jeff. The other thing that occurs to me in reading your two stories here is that the inspectors general of the various agencies, even those on the spook side, have deployed themselves and deported themselves with, respectable efforts. And we've had the CIA's inspector general come forward and expose wrongdoing. The Justice Department, Glenn Fine, has been remarkable in pointing out the abuses of national security letters and other investigative tactics of the FBI. And here we have a case of an inspector general in a very delicate area who nonetheless has attempted to expose the truth here and bring it forward in a significant way. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I must disagree with you on that here.
All right.
I find the inspector, first of all, the Defense Department of Defense Inspector General for Intelligence is the department that looked at Iron Man's allegations. And what they did is they said there's nothing to them.
Oh.
That JFIC, had no role in tracking Osama bin Laden or dealing with Al-Qaeda. Now, they phrased these things interestingly, they had no unilateral role and things like, so they're hedging their language.
Mm-hmm.
But they also never mentioned in Iron Man's complaint, which we did only had when we received it from Iron Man himself, and I think who saw my story and who wrote to me and said, the Inspector General report was, to put it lightly, a lie.
I see.
And
so then basically Iron Man has been pressing the inspector general to do his job properly.
That's right. And the inspector general sat for almost 2 years on his original complaint and didn't do anything.
Mm.
So Iron Man went to the office of the Director of National Intelligence, who then wrote a letter to the inspector general and said, hey, you guys working on this? Whoa. So then they opened up an investigation in early 2008, 2 years or so after Iron Man's complaint. And then at the end of 2008, put it out, and it got declassified earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are.
Well, then I need to retract and redact what I just said about at least about the intelligence inspector general at defense.
Yes, they say that JFIC didn't withhold anything. But they say, interestingly enough, they say they didn't withhold anything from the 9/11 commission. But Iron Man's complaint has nothing to do with the 9/11 commission. Iron Man's complaint said that when in May 2002, a request to assist in a congressional investigation came to JFIC and asked for information, JFIC didn't give that, lied and didn't deliberately misrepresented themselves to Congress, and the Inspector General's report had his complaint in front of them. Of course, they didn't reproduce it in an appendix or anything. Instead, what they reproduced in an appendix, in part, were it was a whole bunch of data about work they had done after May 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Which, what was the point of that? You know, the report is one of the sorriest pieces of investigation work. I don't know if it's just purely incompetence or stupidity, or whether it was a deliberate cover-up or some combination. It's quite an amazing document. I highly recommend that readers look at the actual Inspector General report. It's not very long, and it's very brief, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
The Inspector General report on Able Danger, by the way, is hundreds of pages. You know, the Inspector General report on Iron Man's allegations about the intelligence around Al-Qaeda pre-9/11 is... barely in its major text, barely 10 pages long.
Very interesting.
It's dismissed essentially, and they don't. I don't think they want to say, even in its dismissal, though, I found information of value. There were things that they couldn't. You know, they had to kind of admit, even if they were going to dismiss the totality. And it began to open the door to our discovery of the roles of this area of military intelligence, to the DO5, which had never been written about before, and to this significant briefings that were given to high military and intelligence officials also that had never been reported before. And if I may say finally, I thank you for the forum to talk about this, because I know that both Jason Leopold and myself have gone to great efforts to make sure that other people who write about these kinds of affairs were interested, so we thought, in letting the U.S. public know the truth about how its government works and what's going on behind the scenes, you know, has just ignored this story for reasons that I can't fathom, despite the fact that we have documentary evidence.
Well, I think you've done a powerful job here, Jeff, and it builds on the courageous work that you have done on the ethics of medical professionals and psychologists who participated in torture programs at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And I have a great deal of respect for your work. And I do hope that the corporate media will take a look at this and examine what you've brought forward here, because the American public deserves to know. And the bottom line is, we all deserve an honest investigation into 9/11. It's been 10 years. We have, I think, enough distance here to get beyond the politics. And even if it's a truth commission without any ability to punish those responsible for wrongdoing or negligence, we still, at the bottom of all this, we deserve the truth, and we need to know it to understand the events that have occurred since 9/11.
Yeah. Well, I do want to say, in the press recently, this week, 40 years have gone by, and now we finally get to see the full Pentagon Papers. 40 years. It's been 10 years since 9/11, and major new pieces of information are still surfacing. How long does it take, or do the American people even believe in the truth anymore?
Well, that's a sad question to ask, and one that we'll let linger. Jeffrey Kay, Dr. Jeff Kay, thanks for joining us today, and I will link to your articles at truthout.org.
Thanks very much, Peter.
And we're rolling into segment two of the Peter B. Collins podcast today. And here we're going to learn more about peace activists in the United States subjected to raids by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. On this program, we have recently talked about the Obama administration's lack of transparency, about the expansion of police powers in this country, first under Bush and now under Obama. In the past week, the FBI has released a new investigations manual claiming even greater powers to investigate and detain individuals to gather information without the supervision of a court. Without the issuance of a warrant based on the Fourth Amendment criteria of probable cause. And today we're going to talk about a case where FBI agents raided individuals in three cities on a coordinated basis, gathered information from their computers, and we still don't know the exact scope of the investigation or the purpose of it. Maybe we'll learn something now from attorney Michael Deutsch. He's at the People's Law Office in Chicago, did a stint with our good friends at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York in the 1990s. Michael Deutsch, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, this is a very troubling case because we have seen very little coverage in the corporate media, and I do credit the Washington Post for an article on June 13th detailing your side of the story. But if you could, can you sketch for us last fall, it was in 2010, seven different homes were raided and subpoenas were issued to 23 people whose violations appear to be that they have been active in the promotion of peace and in the promotion of organized labor.
Yes, it's true. 23 people were subpoenaed to a federal grand jury sitting in Chicago who was said to be investigating the material support for designated foreign terrorist organizations. Back in 1996, under President Clinton, a law was passed which allowed the Secretary of State to designate organizations as terrorist organizations, foreign organizations. And then if the law provides that if you provide material support for one of these organizations, you're violating the law. Unfortunately, what material support is has been a broad and long-standing question because the people that are being targeted are people who are nonviolent, peaceful, public people who mostly have exercised their right to write, to publish, to demonstrate, to learn, to educate, all protected by the First Amendment. And they are being targeted as providing material support to several of these organizations. One is a Palestinian group, and one is a group in Colombia. And this is the focal point of their investigation. Essentially, what they're doing is using the First Amendment activities of longtime labor organizers and teachers and professors, and they're trying to criminalize that under this broad interpretation of the material support statute, which many of the Congress people who were involved in passing that law believe is an improper expansion of that law.
Well, indeed, and we recently talked about this in the context of the latest attempt to break the blockade of Gaza. The new Freedom Flotilla is not carrying anything, not medical supplies, not even toys for kids, because it could be construed under U.S. law as material support to Hamas, which is listed as a terrorist organization. And so this is a very creeping police state type of action, Michael. Tell me your thoughts about the legal framework here that the FBI is basing this on.
Well, unfortunately, in June of 2010, the Supreme Court decided a case called Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project.
That's right.
And in that case, human rights workers in the U.S. wanted to advise several groups. One was a Kurdish group that was accused of being on this list, and another was a Tamil Tigers who was fighting in Sri Lanka, who was accused of being on the list. And they wanted to provide them with training to go and file human rights complaints at the UN and training how to engage in peace negotiations. And they brought this case to court because they were fearful that the law, that statute, would be used against them. And in fact, the lower courts, the district court and the court of appeals, said no, that statute, if it was used against this type of First Amendment activity, it would be a violation of the Constitution. And in fact, that this would not be this type of material support, which is defined as training, would not be considered training. It would be protected. Unfortunately, the Obama administration appealed that ruling. That's why the case is Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project.
Mm-hmm.
They appealed that ruling, which is favorable to civil libertarians and the rights of people expressing the First Amendment. And in that ruling, the Supreme Court reversed the lower courts and said, even if you're engaging in First Amendment activity, if it in any way can be construed as providing any material support for one of these organizations that's on the list, then it doesn't, the First Amendment be damned, and you can be prosecuted, and of course you could get up to 15 years in prison. So with that type of green light, the U.S. Justice Department has now taken the step to go after these people who are basically made trips to the Middle East, or in the past made trips to Colombia to learn about what was going on, come back to the U.S. to educate people about what's going on in the Middle East and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and now they're going to be, they're targeted for possible indictment because of their efforts to educate the people of this country about the true nature of those foreign issues. And because the U.S. government takes a one side, they support Israel, of course, full blown, and they also support the government of Colombia, which has been involved in a lot of human rights violations. They don't want that information to be projected to the American people about what these activists are doing. So this is a way to chill them and silence them, and it's a very dangerous escalation of repression against political activists. And it's being done, unfortunately, under the Obama premature, which, you know, then silenced a lot of the Democrats. You remember when Bush would do it,
yeah,
these things, there would be an outcry from the Democrats.
Well, let me just ask you point blank. Jan Schakowsky, the congresswoman from Evanston, a liberal Democrat, was outspoken against the incursions on our civil liberties by the Bush administration. What is her position on these cases, Michael?
Well, to her credit, Jan Schakowsky is one of about 10 congresspeople who have written letters to Attorney General Holder questioning the activities of the FBI and the grand jury in this case.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. I think she's spoken out about it, and several others have as well. But unfortunately, most of the Democrats have remained silent. And in fact, what's happened here is we're going to get an institutionalization of some of these repressive acts, you know, because Bush did it, now the Democrats are doing it, and it's like accepted now. Rendition, military tribunals, this using the law to arrest people and not give them a trial because they claim they're material witnesses. All these things are a continuation of what Bush set into motion after 9/11, and Obama is continuing it and expanding it. You know, all these drone attacks, killing U.S. Targeting U.S. citizens without any due process. All these things are continuing to go on, and it's a very troubling development in the civil liberties area.
And Michael, let's take a moment here for a little history, because you're at the People's Law Office, and Jeffrey Haas, who is a retired former partner of yours, who with Flint Taylor led the 10-year case that ultimately led to a settlement by the U.S. government, and the acknowledgement that the raid in December of 1969 that killed Fred Hampton was an act of state-sponsored killing. And this was one of the excess points, one of the visible excess points of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO program that we thought we had fixed, and that we had reined in these abuses so that they could never occur again. And yet these include some of the same tactics, the pre-dawn raid, the placement of a paid FBI informant in the midst of groups that they are investigating. And aren't we seeing way too much of a replay of the COINTELPRO tactics in Obama's domestic law enforcement activities?
Oh, yes, we are. Unfortunately, we are. And it is a replay, and we thought COINTELPRO and FBI abuse of power was going to be reined in now, but it, in fact, has been expanded. Under this fighting this war on terror, they want to justify everything. They're going after domestic groups as well. They're spying in the case that I'm involved in, that I've been speaking about. They put an informant, a police law enforcement informant, first to infiltrate the work protesting the Republican convention in 2008 in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and then getting involved with these solidarity activists who are based to a great extent in Minnesota, kind of causing them, you know, trying to engender and create issues so they can go back to the government and use them against these people. And it's, yeah, it's 1969 all over again.
So another troubling aspect of this is, at least in the case of your clients in Chicago, Stephanie Weiner, Joe Eisbacher, these are activists who would have been known to Barack Obama, the community organizer. Isn't that fair to say?
Yes, they were community organizers with long history of work in the Chicago area in the labor movement. In addition, a Palestinian man, Hatem Abu Daya, is the executive director of the Arab American Action Network, which was a sponsor of many events. When Obama was a state senator, he would come to these events. He knows these people personally. But the reality is what has Obama done in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict since he became president? He's kind of turned his back on, you know, what he knows about the Palestinian suffering and deprivation, and has basically been beholden to the Israeli lobby almost up and down the line. You know, he said no more settlements when the Israelis just continued to build settlements. He didn't do anything. So, you know, Obama the free candidate, the state senator, is much, much different than Obama, the president.
Now, here's an interesting element that is reported in this Washington Post story, Michael, that I believe one of your clients, Tracy Molm, M-O-L-M, who is a labor organizer with the union AFSCME, they represent government workers, and she's one of the people whose apartments was raided. She managed to interrupt a speech that the Attorney General Eric Holder was giving at the University of Minnesota, and he didn't know, I guess, she was a target of this investigation and agreed to meet with her, and they had at least a brief conversation. I guess he cut it off when he realized that she was directly involved in the case. But she's quoted here in the Post saying, he said they had a predicate for the investigation, and I said, the predicates after 9/11 are nothing. And then he said, we're going to have to agree to disagree. So a predicate is a trigger point. It's a justification for an investigation and the tactics being used here. In the proceedings since the raids, has the government disclosed a predicate for the multi-city raids that occurred last September?
No, everything is being played close to the vest. They're not saying anything. We can assume that the predicate comes from the informant, who, you know, is liable to say anything to justify what, you know, she's about been doing. And the only thing that we know is that some of these people are part of an organization called the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. And a couple of years ago, they sponsored a trip of a Palestinian woman who was part of a Palestinian women's committee in the occupied territories, and she gave a tour of the U.S. and spoke at various places and campuses. And there, the government has implied that her organization is a front group for one of the organizations that's on this list that was prepared back in the mid-90s. So, I mean, it's all very circumstantial and loose, and oftentimes we've seen this in other cases, the government claims that charitable groups are front groups for, you know, for Hamas or some other group that's on the list, and then they use that as a basis to say you're providing material support in terms of money to an orphanage or a hospital or a school, but that school or hospital is supported by Hamas in the end, and by giving money, you're helping Hamas, and that's 15 years in prison.
And it can become quite tortuous, as you just described, because the linkage may not even be apparent to an activist who is trying to mind his or her P's and Q's related to the draconian laws that we're living under now.
Absolutely. And in fact, four of the main five Palestinian groups, political groups, are on the list. And there's hundreds of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which work in those territories to provide humanitarian aid. You might have no idea of what the connections are between people or organizations. They don't publicize that. And so it's all, yes, very torturous and very dangerous in terms of chilling people. The response of people, because some people who were subpoenaed were young college students who went on a trip to the Middle East to learn about what's going on there. They were Jewish, they were Palestinian, they were not even very involved in politics, and now they're being hauled before a grand jury to find out about their trip. And obviously that creates a tremendous chilling effect on anybody who would think about going. Well, I don't want to go because, you know, next thing I know I'll be being hauled before a grand jury to find out what happened on my trip. So it's all very 1984-ish, if you will.
And, Michael, if you could help me out a little bit here, and I'm just going to tick off some of the problematic methods and tactics that have been used in recent years, and maybe you can tell me if they've been involved in this case. Are you aware of any national security letters that were used either before the September raid or after to examine library, banking, or other records of these individuals?
Well, because the U.S. attorney has a grand jury sitting, they can use grand jury subpoenas to gather this information. And we know that they've subpoenaed the bank records of this Palestinian man I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, the bank froze his money and fired him as a client after 5 days of refusing to give his money back. So the government is now exercising that power to look into anything. In national security letters, we have not been notified of any of them being used yet, but we wouldn't necessarily even know that.
That's true.
Because people are under a protective order. If they're given a national security letter, they're not supposed to say they are.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah. Any use of GPS technology? We've heard reports that the FBI now feels empowered to place GPS transponders on people's cars without a warrant or any notice to the individual being surveilled in this manner.
Yeah, that's true, but we haven't had any indication of that as of yet.
Okay. Any video surveillance, any known wiretapping?
Definitely wiretapping. We know the informant was wired and met with people, and we also believe there's phone wiretaps as well.
Okay. And finally in this list here, any attempt to use secret evidence that is not revealed either to you as counsel or to the individual defendants?
Well, we anticipate that there could very well be what they call classified information that won't be available to us, because we believe the Israeli government has been working with the U.S. government as part of this case. And oftentimes what the Israeli government police, secret police do, is they claim that all this information is classified. Their procedures are classified. Information they collected are classified. And we expect that to be raised in this case.
And Michael Deutsch, in these raids and the collection of evidence, were there any episodes of overreaching? Did they injure anybody unnecessarily? Did they take things that they were not authorized to grab or to review?
Well, they didn't injure anyone. There was no physical interaction between anybody whose place was searched. But they took documents that were way beyond any reasonable search warrant. They took the children's poetry, children's books, children's school materials. They took every political pamphlet, every book, posters off the walls, all the computers, you know. So, yeah, they went way beyond what's legitimate, and that will be a subject, ultimately, of, you know, challenge if and when there are indictments.
And have they released any of this so-called evidence that they collected?
A lot of it has been turned back, given back. Not all of it by any stretch, but a lot of the boxes of obviously material that had nothing to do with anything has been returned after several months, been returned to some of the people whose houses were searched.
And, Michael, finally, how would you characterize the role of Patrick Fitzgerald? Is he directly involved in this case?
Yeah, well, he is involved in the case. He's the U.S. attorney. He has a long history of being the fighter against terrorism. When he was in New York, he was very involved in cases and dealing with terrorism.
Well, and he bungled, if you read Peter Lance's book, Triple Cross, Patrick Fitzgerald has a sordid record of terrorism prosecution when he was in the New York district and reporting to later Attorney General Michael Mukasey.
Yeah. He hasn't been victorious by any means, and in fact, several years ago, I tried a case in Chicago when he was the U.S. attorney, charging two Palestinian men with being leaders of Hamas and being part of their military, and they were acquitted of those charges. So, yeah, by no means is he, you know, some super lawyer. But one of the things about him, he doesn't see things in gray area. He's a black and white guy, and I don't think he's very concerned about the First Amendment and certainly not concerned about the rights of people who are critical of the U.S. government.
And
so
do you...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask if you know, when you look at Patrick Fitzgerald and the way he operates, do you have any problems with the failure of the president to exercise his prerogative and replace the 94 Bush-appointed U.S. attorneys across the country?
Well, of course, I wanted President Obama to name progressive judges. He hasn't done that. I wanted him to name progressive people in his Treasury Department. He hasn't done that. I wanted him to challenge the military. He hasn't done that. So, yeah, I'm disappointed, but I'm not surprised. It's consistent with his appointments in all the other areas that he's in charge of. So It's unfortunate, but par for his course so far.
So, Michael, tell us what you expect to happen in the near future here regarding this case.
Well, the grand jury's secret. When and if they'll bring an indictment, you don't know beforehand. I feel fairly strongly that there will be indictments. Now, I don't know the breadth of it or how many people, but unless somebody who's in charge, which would be Holder and Obama, look at this and say, this is wrong and we shouldn't be doing this, and pull the plug on this, they're going to go ahead with indictments. When, I can't say, but it'll be sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. And of this group of defendants or potential defendants, since the indictments haven't been issued, do they have the means to properly defend themselves, or is this a real burden on your People's Law Office and the individuals who are in this circle?
Well, fortunately, around the grand jury, lawyers came forward to represent people. Of course, the commitment to represent someone at a trial is much greater. But I'm confident that progressive lawyers will rally to the case and come forward and support people who are charged.
Well, Michael Deutsch, I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for filling us in on some of the details of this case. And I certainly wish you the best in fighting for our constitutional rights.
Okay, Peter. Take care.
Happy Father's Day. Thanks for listening. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again. Happy trails.